episode 2 coming at you guys on this beautiful Wednesday. Although you guys will probably be listening to this on Thursday, we've got a ton of great content for you guys for episode 2 of Title Talk. But before we do, as always, be sure to follow us on social media. That is Entering Title Town on Instagram. We give the best news, the best analysis, and discussion with all things Boston sports. And if you'd like a video reaction or a video version of this podcast, be sure to check out our YouTube channel. That's a little bit new, and we haven't had it up and running for too long, but we're going to upload the video version of this podcast, and we'll also upload the podcast in segments so you can listen to different topics of discussion at your leisure, and you don't have to listen to the full podcast if you don't like. In that case, that's all I have, and let's jump right into today's content. So we didn't spend too much time discussing the Patriots last week, but as many of you may know, they did start training camp today, this week, and within a couple hours, we had our first big story. Simon Charles on Twitter reported that, quote, Ramondre Stevenson is taking the first team running back reps today for the Patriots in the opening day of training camp, end quote. And he would then go on to say that Damian Harris was seen taking reps with the twos or the second team. In other words, he wasn't out there with Mac Jones and Kendrick Bourne and all those guys. He was behind in that second string. So, I mean, really, really big story for having been in training camp for just, you know, give or take 6 hours when that story dropped. If you just go back to the numbers in 2021, Harris certainly outpaced Stevenson in nearly every category, whether that was because he got more touches or not. I do think he was the better back last year, despite being hurt twice. And so if you're just looking and analyzing the numbers, Harris outpaced Stevenson in rushing attempts, 202 to 133, yards, 929 to 606, and then touchdowns, he tripled them, 15 to 5. Harris reigned supreme there. Now, Harris certainly got more opportunity, and he certainly deserved more opportunity with Stevenson just being a rookie. But it certainly begs the question, putting injuries aside last year, Harris was the bulk carrier. And what did he do either at the end of the season or during the offseason to push Belichick to put Ramondre Stevenson over him this quickly? And keep in mind, you know, Stevenson was a rookie last season. And Belichick's history, as all of you know, with rookies is rather bleak. He never likes to play him a lot aside from, you know, Mac Jones. But we've had discussion about this in the past where a rookie looks really good come out of college. He even may look good in the first couple of weeks in the season. And then we see Belichick kind of trail off of him towards the end, and he doesn't get as many opportunities. That's kind of his playbook for rookies. To see Ramondre Stevenson get as many carries as he did last year and have as much success was a bit surprising. And that could point to why Bill Belichick has already pushed him to compete with Damian Harris come week one. One thing that people I saw mentioned on Twitter for some reason, you know, Harris never had a trouble with any ball control. Neither of them did really. They each had two fumbles last season. That was pretty much a moot point. I mean, I believe it was Ramondre Stevenson who had a pretty costly fumble for us. But it's kind of a wash when both your guys have, you know, two fumbles in the entire season. So that's not really an issue. I saw that being discussed a bit on Twitter, and I didn't really understand it too much. One reason I do think Stevenson may end up getting at least as many reps as Harris this season is because Harris is a free agent in 2023. And we know how Belichick operates with free agents. He doesn't like to pay him. We saw Stephon Gilmore get moved for nothing. We saw J.C. Jackson get let go for nothing. I would suspect Damian Harris is going to see that same fate, and he won't be returning next year. So I think Belichick is already eyeing and planning for that next move, and you might as well get Ramondre Stevenson going. You might as well get a little competitiveness going between him and Harris before the season starts. And who knows? Maybe, you know, Stevenson, you know, becomes the future of the Patriots backfield, and he actually is the one who gets signed to a 4 or 5 year deal when his time comes around. But at least for short notice, I don't think Damian Harris returns, and I think that might be one of the big reasons why Belichick is looking to push the sophomore and the rookie running backs into that top spot, and at least push Harris a little bit further to compete for it instead of letting him just sit back and then walk into free agency. You know, when looking at the future into this season, you know, it's only day one of training camp, so you really can't say for sure whether Stevenson is going to be atop the depth chart when it comes to week one against the Dolphins. But it may come down to a hot hand situation. If Damian Harris is playing really well one game, he might get, you know, upwards of 20 carries. While if Stevenson has a couple of good runs early in, you know, week six or seven, you know, maybe he gets the runs. And I think that is actually a pretty good way to go with how our running back crew is. We have a lot of depth, and both Stevenson and Harris deserve a lot of work this year. And I think they can be a little bit of a cushion for Mac Jones, who doesn't necessarily have one in the wideout department. One thing to note, Stevenson struggled a lot with pass blocking last year. He definitely, you know, as a rookie, wasn't expected to be some elite pass blocker, but it was pretty apparent that he struggled in that aspect. So a lot of the times when you'd see teams blitzing, when you'd have blitz-heavy packages or teams coming into Gillette or, you know, us visiting them, you'd see Belichick run Harris a little bit more often. I think that continues. I don't think that that changes. Even if Stevenson is listed as the one, or he gets, you know, more carry, you know, five, six more carries a game, I still think you see Harris out there for a lot of those play actions, just because Stevenson struggled so much last year, and you can't have Mac Jones getting attacked like that for an entire year. And I think that that is kind of what you're asking to have happen if you let Stevenson out there for too long. And, you know, staying on the topic of Mac Jones, you know, he certainly has to fit into this. If you're trying to decide who fits the Patriots scheme more, Stevenson or Harris, obviously you have to look to the quarterback. If a Mac Jones is going to lean more towards the dumping off short plays this year like he did last year, you might want to go the pass catching route. Whoever, you know, turns out to be the better pass catcher early in training camp, you're going to push for them to be that week one starter. On the contrary, if you, you know, want to look more downfield and you want to use play action more, you might look to Damian Harris because he can pass block more. He's a bit of a better option there. Or if you're just thinking you're going to go run up the middle and, you know, just run him over the entire game and let Mac Jones work later on, you know, maybe Ramondre Stevenson gets the call. So there's a lot of different things that you're going to have to look for within Belichick's plan. Obviously, none of us know what's going to happen. That's how Belichick likes it. But it was certainly a very interesting first couple of hours in training camp with Stevenson taking over for that running back one spot over Damian Harris. So staying on the topic of Mac Jones and kind of veering away from, I guess, well, veering away from the running backs and kind of looking at the offense as a whole, Mac Jones certainly struggled, had his fair share of rookie struggles last season. We saw him make some, frankly, rookie mistakes, and that's, you know, what everyone expected. No one expected him to come up and become Tom Brady. Well, maybe some did, but not the sane ones. And I personally didn't see anything that warranted any drastic changes from last year, but a couple of players thus far in training camp have mentioned that the offense is more simplified this year, and that's a quote from Trent Brown, and that was echoed by Kendrick Bourne. They also noted that there's certainly going to be more of a sped up offense coming this season compared to last year. So my first thought is, when they say sped up, when they say simplified, I'm thinking more play calling, more basic play calling, but more no huddle offense. And so I instantly dove into the numbers, and I wanted to look at exactly why Belichick thought this would be a good decision. So just covering the basics, you know, Brady excelled greatly in the no huddle offense. And a lot of people like to point to Brady being, you know, Mac Jones's comparison, I guess you could say. And so maybe Belichick's, you know, whole thing is to try to work them through that same path. And as Brady became really, really good at running offenses through no huddle, you're trying to get Mac Jones to follow that same way. I don't know. I mean, that's certainly an option. But I think the biggest thing is the numbers simply point to it. Last year in the no huddle offense for the Patriots, we had a 51% success rate, successful play rate on no huddle offenses. And pretty much what that means is you have to gain 50% of the yards required to move the chains on first down, 70% to gain on second down, or 100% to gain on third and fourth down. It's really complicated, but pretty much look at it as like this. if you're first and 10, you get to second and five, that's a successful play. If you're second and 10, you get to third and three, that's a successful play. And if you're third and whatever, and you get the first down, that's a successful play as well. So it's really just like, it's your basic, you gain enough yards to think it's a good play, it's a good play. So on 51% of the no huddle offenses that we ran, we were able to gain a successful play. That's contrary to 50% on huddled offenses. Now you may say, 1%, it's really not that big of a difference. But if you really think about it, if you're analyzing huddled versus no huddled, you're thinking about organized offense versus rushed offense, you'd like to see a bigger discrepancy there. And you didn't last year, at least. And so I pushed even further in, and I wanted to see, in the second half of games, did the Patriots gain an advantage in no huddle, or did they gain an advantage in huddled offense? Was there a bigger discrepancy in the second half of the games? And there actually was. And this is where I think Belichick might be looking to pick this up and kind of exploit it in the year two for Mac Jones. 61% of the no huddle plays in the second half were successful plays. And that's just compared to, again, 50% of the plays called in the third and fourth quarter with huddled offenses were considered successful plays. So that's an 11% difference between successful plays and unsuccessful plays when you're comparing no huddled versus huddled. So quite frankly, in the second half of games last year, we saw a significantly higher successful play rate when we didn't huddle up as an offense. Now, whether that's Belichick pulling the tricks out of the bag in late in the games and people, you know, letting the coaches see stuff they haven't seen yet, I don't know. I mean, you're gonna have to make that determination. That's, you know, more so secretive for the Patriots organization. But there's without a doubt reason to believe that as a whole, the Patriots performed better last year with Mac Jones in no huddle offenses compared to huddled offenses. And so I think personally, that's why Belichick is looking to speed up the offense. And when Trent Brown and Kendrick Bourne say simplified, I really just think that means more call outs, you know, more different audibles that are easier to recognize for the team. And instead of drawing up these crazy plays and having to go through them in the huddle, I think simplifying the game for Mac Jones and really playing to his strengths, which was what we saw last year, is going to provide a lot of cushion for this team that is going to be needed because, like I said, we mentioned in the last podcast, I think Mac Jones might see some regression this year. I hope he doesn't. But did Belichick do enough to help him out? I'm not exactly sure. Maybe instead of helping him out with wide receivers and tight ends, he decided to help him out in the playbook in the scheme category. And so we'll just have to wait and see on that. That'll conclude our coverage for the Patriots this week. We're going to have more storylines, obviously, once we, you know, go into further into training camp. And then obviously once the season rolls around, we'll have a ton of coverage, weekly coverage, frankly. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with some more title talk. You know, Heim Bloom made it pretty clear at the beginning of the offseason that he wanted this team to compete in 2022. And obviously the moves he made, including Trevor Story, you know, Rich Hill, a couple of the bullpen arms, he knew, I think, that this team had the pieces already to compete at a high level, obviously evident of last year. But it did need a little bit of push and a little bit of backup, you know, to beat the Astros, to beat the Yankees, stuff like that. And I think he went out and made those moves. And I might be in the minority there, but I think Heim Bloom made some fantastic additions in the offseason. And some of them simply haven't panned out. But now let's fast forward to July. We're just 5 days away from the deadline. The Red Sox are at 500. They're currently playing right now. I'm not sure what the score is. Every game matters at this point, so you're kind of scoreboard watching. And they're in the best division in baseball, and they're in last place, and they only have themselves to blame, frankly. They had a really hot June, really hot late May, and then July was just an absolute train wreck. So now the questions are being asked, you know, rightfully so, to Heim Bloom, to John Henry, to all of the front office. What do you do at this point? They're in a really weird spot. They are only, I believe, 3.5 out of the wild card, final wild card spot, yet it feels like we're 10 out. And so Heim Bloom has, frankly, not answered a lot of the questions that he's been given by the media. He said stuff, you know, trying to play both sides and taking it day by day and this and that, which I don't totally disagree with, but at least from your GM, you'd like to have a little bit of clarity that he hasn't necessarily given a couple days before the deadline. But you also have to understand, you know, he can't show his hand. He can't reveal to any teams that he wants to possibly look at offers for Bogarts or, you know, go after Josh Bell or whatever it may be. He has to make sure he keeps that under wraps, which is understandable. And I think the media understands that as well. But I'm going to look at both sides in this episode because, frankly, we only have one episode before the trade deadline. Next episode, it's going to look completely different whether the Red Sox decide to buy or sell at the deadline. And so I thought, let's look at both and let's reason for both because there is reason for both. And we can kind of make that assessment at the end. So the reason to buy. The problem for the Red Sox right now is not the supply of potential players they can get that can help them. There is an enormous amount of talent out there that teams are trying to sell. Teams that are in much worse spots than the Red Sox. Andrew Benintendi for the Royals. He's obviously a household name in Boston. He's been someone who's gotten brought up with the Sox. The need for a bat in the outfield, obviously, with JBJ and Duran really hitting very poorly at the bottom of the lineup, you know, that might provide some assistance that you need. He's been a name that's been thrown around and has been welcomed by most Red Sox fans. Obviously, he has his issues with getting into Canada and stuff like that, and that is a whole other separate thing. But in terms of just his play on the field, I think every Red Sox fan realizes that he would be a really good addition to a team that's trying to push for the playoffs. Josh Bell, we just mentioned him earlier, first baseman for the Nationals. He's going to be dealt without a doubt. He could go to a number of different teams. A lot of people suspecting that he's going to be the first guy to get dealt to kind of set the market. But he would help immensely. He can slot in at first base, which has been a crapshoot for the entire year with Bobby Dalbec and Franchy Cordero. Neither of them providing too much assistance in the past month and a half or so. In the pen, David Robertson for the Cubs. He would, again, be a great addition to a bullpen that has struggled all year but has since recovered a bit with Whitlock and Houck and Schreiber being the three guys that can get us through that 7-8-9 stretch. If you can add another guy, you know, great. You should be able to win more games when you add another bullpen arm. And I think it's a necessity if the Sox want to compete that they need to add another pen arm to provide a little bit of cushion for the guys that are going every other day. And then, you know, if you're looking at the starting rotation with Chris Sale's injury, who knows when he's going to be back, if he'll even be back. You probably do need an arm in the starting rotation to help you out. And so, you know, guys like Frankie Montas or Luis Castillo, both of those guys have been thrown around in different trade deals. They would both probably cost a good amount. Because I believe they're both under contract for after this year as well. So they're not just rentals. But again, it could also be someone you look for to add for the future when Nathan Eovaldi and Nick Pivetta are both potentially leaving rather soon. You might need some help in the rotation for next year and the year after that as well. So some of these additions, I think, could also help us out for years to come and not are just simply rentals. But those are just a couple names right there that we've already seen. So the problem is not supply for the Red Sox. It's what type of demand do the Sox have? Does adding any of those above players make them better than the Astros? Maybe you could make the argument. Do any of them make them better than the Yankees? I would say no. I think the Yankees starting nine is one of the better starting nines we've seen in baseball in a number of years, maybe since the Red Sox in 2018. When all those guys are hitting, they're really tough to beat, whether they have their five starter on the mound or they have Nestor Cortez on the mound. It really doesn't matter, I don't think, when their lineup is hitting 1-9. And that 2-3-4 of Rizzo, Judge, or Judge Rizzo Stanton is just frightening as a Red Sox fan. Obviously, we've competed well against them. I believe we're .500 against them this year. But if you're talking about who just has the better lineup, everyday lineup, I certainly don't think adding Benintendi to this roster makes it comparable with the Yankees. That's just kind of my opinion, but you guys can let me know what you think in the comments. And, you know, another thing is the Sox are not just a middling team. This, you know, we were one of the better teams in baseball, if not the best team in baseball in June. Yeah, you can make the argument the Yankees were probably ahead of us because of their insane record, but you know, behind them, I don't see any other team that could really compete with us when we were on. So this isn't a team that's floated around 500 for the year. This is a team that in mid-May hit a stride and, you know, went on, you know, some ridiculous, you know, 35 wins and, you know, 15 losses or something like that. A really, really good run, a really strong run to show what the potential of this team is. So I don't think it's a normal 500 team right now. I think you have to look at it differently. You have injuries coming back. Story will be back. Evaldi. Whitlock is hitting his stride. Devers currently on the DL or the IL, but he will be coming back post-deadline, I believe. So there's reason to believe that with some addition, the Sox should be able to push themselves into the wild card. They have one of the better rosters out of the five or so teams that are competing for that final wild card spot. And so when it comes down to the final stretch, I go with the team who has the better roster, who has the better players. So I think the Sox do have a roster built for the playoffs. Now, do they have a roster built for the World Series? That's when you have the seller argument come in with the question of, are they better than the Yankees or the Astros? And at that point, if you answer no to either of those questions, you're pretty much giving up the fact that they're not going to get to the World Series and that they'll probably get bounced in the ALCS or even maybe the ALDS. At that point, you start looking at the contracts we have, and there are a number of guys that would be that would fetch a lot of return if you decide to become sellers at the market, at the trade deadline. Those deals include JD Martinez. He will likely be on, if he does come back, it'll be on a 1 year, a cheaper deal. It depends on if he wants to stay in Boston. Christian Vasquez, I'm assuming he goes and gets paid somewhere. I can't see us paying too much for a catcher, but I know some teams certainly will. Nate Evaldi, he's kind of a question mark, but again, another expiring starter that's going to be on the market, similar to Erod. You may have thought he was going to come back, and then he went ahead and signed somewhere else. And then Rob Refsnyder as well. He's someone who's kind of been a surprise in our system, but he could fetch a little bit of return as well. He's hit really, really well over the past month or so, and someone, you know, either looking to add a little bit of depth in their bench or looking for a spot outfield start every once in a while certainly would be in favor of acquiring someone like Rob Refsnyder. So you have four or five guys that you certainly could look to move, and you would retain a lot of value right now in terms of prospects and also in terms of MLB ready talent that you could use next season and for future years. I think another argument for the sellers is that, you know, there's simply too much ground to be made up with the pitching woes that have happened. Chris Sale kind of sealed that deal. Nathan Evaldi got rocked in his return. So there's a lot of different pieces of the pitching staff that simply aren't working this year. And if you're thinking about going to a wild card start with Nick Pivetta or someone of that sort, it doesn't give you a ton of confidence. And even if you make it past there, what's your rotation looking like headed by Nate Evaldi and Nick Pivetta? Connor Siebold has gotten rocked. Brian Bayo has gotten rocked. A lot of the guys we would hope could come in for that spot start simply haven't. And so that's another cause for concern and another reason why you might be in favor of the Sox selling, because it just doesn't seem like their pitching is deep enough. Just looking ahead to next season, if you decide to sell, you have a lot of hopeful things that you want to have happen, if that makes any sense. Casas is likely to be called up and start next season at first base. You're hopefully going to have a healthy Sale. You have a lot of money to spend this offseason, especially if you let some of these guys go. So there is a lot of, you know, kind of give in now to benefit later kind of talk from the seller market, or from the seller side, I guess you could say. And so I kind of understand both. It's tough to really make a determination until we see how the Sox perform over the next couple of games. I kind of mentioned it on Titletown earlier in the week. If they are 3.5 back, 4 back, they're not going to sell. There's just simply, that's not how the Boston Red Sox have been in the past. It's not how they will be. And I say if they're under 5 games behind whoever's in that third spot, I think that they continue to compete and continue to try to make the playoffs and even potentially go out and get a rental. But if they are past that 5 mark, I think that's when they might look at dumping off a couple of these guys, you know, Vasquez, JD, fetch a decent return, maybe get a player who you can use next season and the year after that, and kind of look to make the team and keep the team competitive, but also keep in mind that this simply might not be your year. We kind of tiptoed around this segment or this topic in the last segment. You guys probably noticed I didn't mention either Rafi Devers or Xander Bogaerts because I wanted to kind of save this part of the podcast for them because there's a lot of discussion about them. They're two cornerstone pieces of the franchise. They were, you know, Xander was has been here since, I think, 2013. Rafi was key in the 2018 win. They're household names now, and they're cherished here in Boston. But they might not be here for much longer, and that's where the discussion starts. And Chaim Bloom has been getting grilled over the past couple of weeks about this by the media. Tom Caron interviewed him, and Chaim Bloom, when asked about whether they had any plans to trade either Rafi Devers or Xander Bogaerts at the deadline, he said, quote, "We don't plan to." So if that provides you any sort of reassurance, I guess that you can take that for what it's worth. To me, those simply just, you know, "we don't plan to." It seems a little bit weird for him to say "we don't plan to," as if that opens the door for the, you know, slim chance that they might actually move Rafi Devers before Tuesday. That's frightening. I can't even imagine what Sox Twitter, Sox Instagram, whatever, Sox social media will look like if that's the case. But if you're looking at just the facts, there is a reason for Chaim Bloom making those comments. Xander Bogaerts is likely going to be on at the end of the year. He has Scott Boras as his agent. Scott Boras is historically really tough on players returning to teams midseason with extensions. It seems like the Red Sox don't value Xander where he values himself. He will get what he wants on the open market. I'm sure he looked at Trevor Story and saw what Story got from the Red Sox. I'm sure he looked at Carlos Correa and saw what he got from the Twins. There are a number of different comparisons you can make in the past couple of years. And I think if Xander doesn't get that or close to it or even above it, he's going to say goodbye. And, you know, a team like the New York Yankees or even the Houston Astros, who just let Correa go, might look to get another shortstop back and go after a Xander Bogaerts. Devers, on the other hand, is still under contract for another year after this one, but it is arbitration, and after that, he's an unrestricted free agent. So both of them have a very, very tight future with the Red Sox. There's not much room for error. Xander has a couple of months to make this up. Devers has probably 6 or 7 months. And so the last known offers for both of them were both complete lowballs. Xander was presented preseason with a 6 for 90. That's a $15 million average annual value. That's insulting for a guy like Xander Bogaerts. And then Rafael Devers, as recently as a couple weeks ago, right before the All-Star break, confirmed that he was comped to Matt Olson. And Matt Olson just received an 8 for 167, which is a $21 million average annual value. Just to give you guys some perspective, Aaron Judge has been offered $32 and $33 million from the Yankees. He's awaiting free agency to go look for 35. Even if you think Rafael Devers isn't as good of a player as Aaron Judge is, you at least have to put Rafi in the $30 million range. And for him to receive 21 a year for the next 8 seasons, it can be compared to Matt Olson. It's insulting. I'm not sure who came up with that offer, whether it was Chaim Bloom or John Henry or a mixture of both. It's ridiculous. And Xander's too, 6 for 90. I mean, the guy can go get 8 years or 10 years if he probably wants to. I'm sure a team will give him that money. Major League Baseball doesn't, in the MLB, you really don't care too much about spending. And there are teams that will overspend for shortstops. He will get that money. It's just a matter of, does him having a home in Boston, does him being, you know, one of these generational names in Boston history play into the fact that he wants to, you know, maybe take a discount? I don't know. I don't think so. I think Xander's as good as gone. But Devers, on the other hand, you've got to work him out rather quickly. And a lot of people probably are surprised to hear Chaim Bloom make the comments of "we don't plan to trade him," as if that still, you know, there is still a possibility. But if we look back at the Mookie Betts saga that we now have to return to because of this report by Alex Speer, Alex Speer wrote in the Globe just yesterday that the Sox were really close to trading Mookie Betts back in 2019 at the deadline. Obviously, you guys know about 6 months later, he was then moved for Jeter Downs, Connor Wong, and Alex Verdugo. But that 2019 deadline, where the Sox were in a pretty similar spot with where they are now, the report is that Dave Dombrowski did not want to trade Mookie Betts And John Henry did. And the comment that Dave Dombrowski made to John Henry was, quote, they'd, referring to the fans, burn my house down if we trade Mookie Betts. That's frightening for a couple of different reasons. One, that showed that Dave Dombrowski and I guess GMs as a whole might actually give in to the fear that the fans put forth, which is a little disconcerting. You'd like to think they'd be a little bit more professional than that. But it also, more importantly, shows that John Henry would have traded Mookie Betts a lot earlier than any of us would have expected. And at that point in time, I think everyone believed Mookie Betts was going to return as a Red Sox next year. The contract discussions were going to get figured out, and that was going to be that. But the fact that Rafael Devers is in the exact same spot as Mookie Betts was in 2019 at the deadline scares the crap out of me, because this is the same scenario. Mookie Betts was holding out for his contract. He had one more year left in 2020 with the Red Sox, and then he was going to become a free agent. Devers, holding out for his contract, has one more year left next year, and then he's off into the free agency. He is in the exact same scenario. It shows that John Henry will do what all of us don't want him to do, and he won't bat an eye. And I would be very worried about Devers, frankly, leaving a lot sooner than any of us would have liked. Xander, I kind of expect to go at this point, because I think the story signing gave Bloom a lot of cushion, and he provides that shortstop that you need if Xander decides to leave. And frankly, I think he would have been back if he wanted to be back here. I think discussions would have been very, very apparent before the season started, and there was a lot of lack of reporting between the two, and it didn't seem like there was much discussion going on at all. So I think Xander is likely gone, but Devers, people need to really get with a reality check and realize John Henry will do whatever he wants to, no matter if the fans like it or not. We believed it, and we've now confirmed it with the Mookie Betts report that came out of the Globe, and it's certainly going to be a very interesting 5 days for the Sox, whether their two cornerstone pieces are actually still teammates by the end of the week. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with probably the story of the week in Boston, if you can believe it. So just last week on the podcast, in the sports world, everyone was really kind of assuming that the KD rumors to the Celtics, Jaylen Brown to the Nets, all of that was pretty silent now. That wasn't going to happen. There wasn't really ever a chance that KD was going to come to the Celtics. And that all changed Monday morning when Woj and Shams both kind of double-teamed a report drop. Woj coming really early in the morning, then Shams coming a little bit later. But the essence of what they're saying is that KD to Boston is alive, and Shams reporting that an offer was made by the Celtics for Kevin Durant that included Jaylen Brown, Derek White, and a draft pick. It was swiftly declined by the Nets, and then Brian Windhorst of ESPN also noted that that offer was likely made weeks ago. There wasn't really an indication that this was like a recent offer within the past week or anything like that, but wow, it certainly sparked a lot of discussion. That was really the talk. It has been the talk in Boston for the past week. And it reopens the can of worms that I wished was closed, quite frankly. But let's reopen it. Do the Celtics really need KD? Quite frankly, no, I don't believe so. They got to Game 6 of the NBA Finals. They got to within one quarter of going up 3-1, getting that third win, that coveted third win. And unfortunately, they blew that fourth quarter. But they came within a couple of games of winning the NBA title. If they win the NBA title, none of this conversation is happening, obviously, and people realize that. So it's the fact that they just simply didn't beat Steph Curry and the dynasty. Now that's why we have to blow up the team and trade everyone, and that's just how a lot of Boston fans react sometimes. And another note is that it wasn't Jason Tatum keeping us in the finals. It wasn't Jason Tatum helping us try to push to Game 7. It was Jaylen Brown. He was your main guy in the NBA Finals this season. And, you know, he ended the playoffs with a 23-point-per-game average on 46-37-76 splits. As a two, that is unbelievable. And the fact that people seem to kind of forget that Tatum was absent throughout the entire NBA Finals, and that the fact that we won two games is evident that Jaylen Brown can step up and he can push the team to another level, even without Tatum performing to his highest potential. And that was really the biggest question when people had at the beginning of the year. Can Jaylen Brown step up when Tatum can't? And I think that question was answered, which is interesting to me that people now seem to believe that's when we should trade Jaylen Brown. Obviously, there was discussion mid-season when they weren't working out. But now that it's proved that both of these two are extremely talented players, extremely a lot of chemistry between the two, it doesn't make any sense to me now all of a sudden trade rumors are starting for a guy that, you know, frankly has commitment issues to both the city and the franchise, to whoever he plays for, is not something I would like to have in Boston, quite frankly. And a lot of people like to point to the fact that Jaylen Brown wants out or is going to leave at the end of his contract. That was a ridiculous report by a ridiculous Boston source that has been wrong numerous times, that simply just tries to stir the pot. It's been proven wrong by ESPN sources stating that Jaylen Brown wants to be in Boston. Despite the rumors, he likes it here. He wants to come back even after his contract is up. So all of that is all, you know, BS speculation. That's simply not true. Anyone who claims that is, you know, a real report, I don't really take that seriously at all. But let's play devil's advocate for a second. Why do Celtics fans want Kevin Durant? Well, the biggest thing is he's a better player than Jaylen Brown. I don't think anyone's denying that. If you put Kevin Durant in place of Jaylen Brown in the starting roster, your team gets better. Just straight up skill-wise, talent-wise, without a doubt. It is tough in the NBA, if you just look back at the past, you know, 20 or so NBA champions, it is tough to win an NBA title without a top five player or so in your league, on your team. So a top five player in the league likely is rostered on an NBA Finals roster. The LeBron Curry run that we had in the 2010s, even if you look at who kind of split that up, you had Giannis split it up, and you had Kawhi Leonard split it up. Two, again, top five players in the league at the time. It's really tough to win when you don't have that type of talent on your roster. It's not really a gripe at Tatum, but if you don't think Tatum is a top five player yet, which I don't personally think he is yet, that might be where you look to go acquire someone like that, and that instantly makes you a contender. Now, Tatum is likely going to be a top five player in the league in a matter of years, whether it be this next year or the year after that. Within the next couple of years, Tatum is likely to hit that, likely to eclipse that. So that kind of puts that argument to rest. If you're looking to trade for KD as a rental, you're probably doing it wrong. And especially if you're looking to give up Jaylen Brown, one of your cornerstone pieces, for a year or two of KD, it doesn't really seem to make any sense to me personally. But those are really the main arguments for why you'd like to make a move for Kevin Durant. The biggest thing is people think Jaylen Brown wants out, and it's simply not true. It's been proven wrong multiple times before. If that was the case and you said, would you rather have Jaylen Brown for two more years or Kevin Durant for 2 years? I would pick Kevin Durant without a doubt. But rarely do you ever see teams or GMs play that way, where they're just assuming 2 years into the future that one of their players isn't going to return, and that you want to get the most out of those 2 years as possible. You know, Jaylen Brown's only 25. You know, he's got a good 6 or 7 years left of like prime basketball, along with Jason Tatum, who probably has an additional 2 to 3 years of prime basketball after that 5 or 6 is up. You have one of the youngest and one of the best dynamic duos in the entire league, and I can't find any valid reasoning to why you'd like to move one of those players for a rental of a guy that frankly has not worked out in any franchise other than when he is surrounded by a bunch of superstars. And even then, if you look in Brooklyn, you know, with Kyrie and Harden, it didn't work out. Harden has cited Kevin Durant, that there was issues there. Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant don't seem to want to play together, obviously. Kevin Durant struggled with Russell Westbrook and OKC after their collapse. Even Draymond Green has cited issues with Kevin. So there's so many issues with Kevin Durant. I don't know why people think that he would be able to come to Boston, probably the most critical city in America for sports, and he would just be able to compete. I don't get it. I don't understand the conversation, but it has to be had now because there are valid reports that, that seem to validate people's opinions and predictions that KD will be a Celtic by the end of the offseason. I hope he isn't. Let me know what you guys think in the comments, but to me, it's pretty clear. So that's going to do it for us here at Title Talk. We appreciate all of our listeners and encourage you to subscribe to our YouTube channel if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, head over to our YouTube channel, check it out. We'll have all of the segments clipped up together, and you can kind of, you know, go piece by piece. And if you just want to go back to a segment and listen to it, you can do that too. And certainly go follow us on Instagram. You'll be the first to know when we're recording, when our podcast is posted, and all of that. So this is Title Talk. I'm Jordan Haddock, and until next week, enjoy the Pats training camp. Pray for Bergeron to sign back because it's getting a little late. And please let Jaylen Brown stay a Celtic come next week. See you guys. She said, I think I'm gonna bar.